Hello and welcome to episode 30, sort of Heirs for Architecture's third series, on which Catherine Ingram, current professor and former chair of graduate architecture at the Pratt Institute, New York, speaks about her 2023 book, Architecture's Theory, published by MIT Press.
Heirs for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Heirs for Architecture. I'm talking today to Professor Catherine Ingram, the Pratt Institute in New York. Thank you for being with me today, Catherine. Would you be able to introduce yourself, please?
Yes, I'm currently a professor at Pratt Institute and have been here for about since 1998, where I came in and I started the Masters of Architecture program at the Institute and have continued to teach there after that. With various visiting faculty episodes at Harvard and Columbia and other places in which have always enriched in some way my research and other parts of my work. I have also published a number of books. The first one was The Architecture, The Burdens of Linearity, and the second one was Architecture, Animal, Human. And the third one is this Architecture's Theory, recently published. And there was another one that was I edited at the very beginning of the movement of sort of deconstruction in architectural circles.
And that was, when was that one?
That one was in back at University of Illinois in, I think it must have, the mid to late 80s. And I did it through Stanley Tigerman. I was teaching there at that moment. This was a kind of an ad hoc job I had because I was coming in from my former training as I have a PhD in comparative literature from Johns Hopkins University. And so I was coming in from that into architectural mode, and Stanley Tigerman hired me. Because it turned out that Peter Eisenman and Stanley Tigerman were all interested at that moment in deconstruction, and they didn't have very many people that knew much about it. And that was what I did in Comp Lit, was post-structuralism nonstop at Johns Hopkins.
Fantastic. What a career. And to be both the founder of the MArch program and a scholar, it's difficult. I mean, teaching is an exacting enterprise on its own without having to be a thinker as well.
Yeah. I discovered that when you're leading a program, actually you can't continue teaching for a while. You can go back to it when things are settled, but it's just that you're absolutely right that it's an entirely different mood and entirely different to present, sort of preparation and so forth. However, I certainly was using at that point my interests and, whatever I had already worked upon, my research into certain kinds of relationships to architecture that had to do with, this philosophical, but also, architectural thinking and otherwise. But that was at work in my research at that moment. And so I was starting this program with that not to have people study that, but to actually think through a Masters of Architecture program that included, and at that time it was true, it was including studio training and history theory training were mixed up together, and theorists were teaching studios at Columbia. I was teaching studios at Columbia. And so were other theorists and other historians. And that was a very unique kind of, after a while that stopped because I stopped teaching studio because I said, well, I'm not building buildings and somehow teaching studio without somehow that more knowledge about that would be, it began to be like, wait, my thinking over here wants to go over here to these more, I guess you could say, sort of research, theoretical research domains. Mm-hmm. So that was, it was interesting moment because, and it sort of petered out in a certain way, but the ideas didn't peter out, but the sort of the format petered out at Columbia. The paperless studios began to take over from the digital was coming in stronger and stronger in the 90s. And so all the attention was turned to that, which it had to be because the software was changing, you know, every single year there was a new software. And so it had to all be learned. And so there was this about 10-year period of learning after that intense moment of, specifically at Columbia, of sort of post-structuralism.
It's interesting that you come to architecture from a literature, a comparative literature background. And the book that we're talking about, your book that we're talking about today, which you published, which you mentioned earlier, which you published with MIT, Architecture's Theory, uses this word post-structuralist quite a lot. And obviously post-structuralism comes after structuralism. Perhaps it would be useful to understand in a brief way what this means. What is post-structuralism? First of all, I guess within the broader humanities, particularly literature, and then how it's been realized, what it is in within architecture, what it's seen to be within architecture.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what this book, Architecture's Theory, was looking at. It was looking at, to some degree, the specific theory that was, you know, called deconstruction, post-structuralism, you know, that Derrida was involved with, all the Derrida and Deleuze and many of the French theorists and so forth. So it was concerned with that, but to begin with, but it was actually, the book is not specifically concentrating on that, although it uses the word post-structuralism fairly commonly. I'm actually speaking far more generally in that book, or trying to speak more generally in that book about not just what theory made of architecture, but what architecture made of theory. In other words, what happened to my, you know, it's a kind of great case study of somebody coming from an intense, you know, Hopkins was one of the centers of post-structuralism in Comp Lit. It was very, everybody was going there, all, you know, Derrida was there, everybody was there, Said was there coming through, everybody was there. And so it was like really hot. When I came in as a graduate student, I had no idea, you know, what it was. And so you get sort of incorporated into these concepts, and they are complex and they're philosophical, and so you need background and so forth that you have to build up. But when it went into why architects got interested in it, which I was surprised to discover, that's probably the only reason I ended up connecting with architecture, with the exception of the family history, you know, which is all architecture all the way back, that I knew nothing about architecture really as I went in to teach it with Stanley and Tigerman's group. But there was, the thing is that, and why were they interested, you know? And Bernard Tschumi was interested because he came from France and he was involved in Paris with all the discussions around, you know, post-structuralism. And so he liked it that I knew, you know, that I'd been trained in that. So it gave me a door in to this. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, what was I doing? You know, I was kind of had derailed my Comp Lit, you know, doctoral sort of position. And I had stopped teaching that, and I decided I was going to go teaching architecture. Yeah, it was a very kind of messy thing, you know, like why do you do that? I don't know. But the thing is, when I discovered that architecture was interested in it, and I naturally wanted to teach because I'd been trained, you know, and as a PhD person, you know, that teaching is where you're in research. So I wanted to teach, and when I went into the architecture, it just it was so exciting. It was like architecture was like had ton of stuff going on that it had failed to notice, in my opinion, you know, and I think that's what Stanley and Peter were up to too, that they were wanting to open the hood, you know, and look under the hood of the discipline and practice at that moment, because it had gone through modernism, postmodernism, it's just marching along in its sort of, you know, sort of epochs. And so in a way, I would say that theoretical moment wasn't new theory, particularly. There have been many theories throughout architectural history that are incredibly important and have been transformative. So it just was another theoretical moment, you know, of some kind. But it clearly things had become, I think, modernism, because of modernism in particular, which is just so loaded with stuff, and we're still studying it, you know, in many aspects, that modernism in particular had frozen a certain kind of thinking about architecture. And it was and it was insisting on a sort of centralized, you know, sort of rigor, especially the international style. I mean, when that book gets written, it's like, you know, it's like telling you what kind of lettering you should have on the building, you know, what font you should use, you know, and it's telling you, you know, exactly what kind of windows and how the, you know, how the curtain wall works and everything else. And so I thought, well, that is all being taken as just something that's given by the modernist sort of theoretical stance. And it's just loaded with interesting presuppositions and authoring of, you know, sort of the tactics and the procedures and the pedagogy of the architectural work. And so I just went in there and I started looking at Le Corbusier first, right? Because of course I took the popular, you know, blah blah blah, the ones who are most interesting, and and I started working on, like, well, what's going on here? What is this, you know? And it began to reform what my main point is, that it began to reform my own relationship to post-structuralism. And I think now I have probably some kind of hybrid form of post-structuralism that if a Derridian read my book, they would probably notice all sorts of, you know, mistakes and flaws or somehow stuff that they wouldn't agree to and so forth. And if architects read the book, they find all sorts of stuff and things that they don't, you know, they think are, you know, too literary or something else. So it's the hybridity of, yeah.
And I really like this idea, and we can perhaps come to this idea of modernism being loaded with stuff, as you put it. It's sort of a totalizing vision, isn't it? Whereas structuralism proposes that human culture can be understood as a sort of modeling language.
It was language, yes, to be sure, because de Saussure, you know, they were looking at de Saussure, who had already now began to show how language was a kind of hidden system that we don't really know about, but we practice all the time and is in effective ways, and it has many rules, and yet the same thing, you know, and so it's a ruled system that we all use in different ways. Could be different languages, but we're still, language is huge as a sort of shared system, and so it shows up there. But Levi-Strauss also was trying to say that it showed up in rituals, it showed up in mythologies, the way mythologies work, and especially it showed up in kinship. In other words, a description of kinship was always a paired, you know, father, mother, brother, sister. You know, and so forth, relations of pairs. And so these were part of, and those are contested by sometimes, you know, some people say, no, that doesn't really prove it, that, you know, if every, the main one that I mentioned actually in my earlier comment was when Levi-Strauss arrives at what he sees as this simultaneously natural and cultural concept of incest, that every culture has a theory and a rules of incest. And that's biological on the one hand, because incest, of course, is not good for the species, but so you could say it's a kind of biocultural development. And that's what he says, it's both nature and culture at the same time, which is very unusual. In our understanding of nature, we don't usually, those things are separate. So Derrida, when he gets into the post-structural, uses Levi-Strauss in this Structure, Sign, and Play article to to show how that crossover from nature to culture, which is common to every society and every culture, has mythologies about nature, culture has all sorts of rituals, has all sorts of, you know, biological relations and food and all this other stuff. So he uses that to show how post-structuralism works, and he says almost the only way it can work, because if you start, because it's impossible to imagine us, you know, delving into structures, because we need structures and we're using structures nonstop. We're in structures all the time. And so what would it mean to sort of start questioning the function of the structure? Is it, I mean, because it's you can't unpack it without using its own terms, you know, and so that's a huge thing that you have to sort of, he explains a little bit how that might work. And the nature culture thing is a good example, because you have to, you can't, I mean, you can't get out of the way, you know, the nature culture has it, each term has its own sort of values and it has a certain kind of expression depending on the culture. But that what you do, and this is what Levi-Strauss does, is he starts to use it as a methodological sort of, it stands in as a methodological inquiry that you can, that where allows you to see the limits of these relations. And the limits of the relation is what the total, what the you know, structurality of structure, it has to use the systems that are already in place in order to open the systems and to question the systems. But it can't just make a wholesale sort of destruction of the system, because you need it to get into it. And so he says, it's like you just pick here and there, you go in there and pick here and there the limits of that structure, or how it proposes in some cases a sort of a limitation on, I mean, it poses a sort of a restriction of certain kinds of ways that you might unearth what it means. And those limits are very important, because they also show the power of the structure. The power of the structure lies in this thing he calls center of the, you know, we have, if this is going on now in the sort of colonial critique, in, you know, when we, in the last 20 years, we've been talking about colonialism in many different ways, how subtle and yet, you know, sort of systemic it was and is, remains. So we're in this now, paradigm shifts about people and trying to, so we're actually kind of in this structurality sort of deconstruction of the structure of colonialism, or of other things that are not strictly colonialism, but are like colonialism, and so forth. Identity issues, racism, all this stuff. So I think that's interesting.
Mm.
I don't know if that's a good, you know, there's a lot more to say about it.
You've talked about how it's revealed in Derrida's work, but how is it then deployed by architecture? Where do we see this manifesting? Is this in work of people like Peter Eisenman, who obviously is inspired by Derrida, and this idea of a deconstructivist, I suppose, architectural form?
I think there was a kind of mistake in architecture. This was when they also, MoMA held an early conference about deconstruction in architecture, and they went down into their archives and they brought out all these paintings that were everything from, you know, sort of early 20th century sort of abstract paintings and then abstract expressionism. They were trying to think through what it meant, deconstruction, and they thought it meant disorder and collapse. And the interesting thing again about this Structure, Sign, and Play article is that I mean, the sort of introduction to deconstruction, is it said it's not 100% about about destruction, what it's about is sort of critique that that again can't afford to somehow kill the thing it's critiquing, because otherwise, you know, then you're not into
it's just a descent into absurdity at that point.
That's right. And I think because structure and structurality is so endemic to architecture, we think about it all the time. We're structuralists, you know, we want to, we structure space, we organize space, we create uses of space, we are incredibly structurally oriented, that I think architects immediately began to think that it was, and Peter thought this too, that it was about just a kind of collapse or a threat of collapse in the building. I think Peter's most interesting projects are the ones where he begins to operate on things like pillars and staircases and the suspension of the pillar doing no work, just suspended at next to the pillars that are doing the work. Suddenly you have a suspended pillar that is doing nothing. And this was partly postmodern as well, that the postmodernist architect like Venturi started to play with the staircase going to nowhere, the breaking of the gable and so forth. And so there's the idea of actually sort of repurposing what we depend on in architecture to be functional, you know, or structural, was a natural response, I think, an interesting response. I think OMA did that in a very slippery way, interesting way as well, you know, by taking the pilotis and beginning to bend it around and have it going up like legs rather than just, you know, sort of vertically supporting buildings. And there was a lot of experimentation with it in different forms. But I think MoMA got it wrong in that initial symposium, because it wasn't about the picture of disorder. It does disorder things to some degree. It has to disorder some things, but I don't think it should be literally translated into a destroyed building that is still functional. Although under certain circumstances that might work, but it's very, what's the word? It's very, it's sort of very literal understanding.
Where does Architectural Theory, Architectures Theories, where does it position in relation to, say, for example, this? I suppose it's a sort of, perhaps ironically, a chronology, a kind of theory from structuralism to post-structuralism, and, you know, the Derridan, Eisenman kind of position where they're using the structure, I suppose, to question the structure.
Yes.
Where does your book position in relation to that? Are you attempting to reaffirm that position? Are you simply describing that position, or are you pointing to where that position has led us to and is likely to point to in the future?
Well, in my defensive theory, I guess you could say, I'm suggesting that we still are in an that we're in a world that, you know, requires thought, and it requires interpretation, and thinking back on that, the chapter that I'm talking about that Derrida wrote, he talks about it as an event, which is the event of an era in an era, and whether he's talking about the era of the late 20th century or the era of earlier or whatever, you could say that it's in our era that we believe in interpretive sort of positions. But it's true that there's a huge amount of opposition to that. In other words, you could see that people, I mean, I think we're kind of in a place where interpretation is what we're in is this truth battle now. That's the interesting thing about our era right now is that truth is in crisis. The idea of truth. Truth is problematic. I don't want to digress into that, but it's I think that all I'm saying is that whatever was going on, the deconstructive work that Derrida did philosophically, linguistically, in relation to, to many kinds of systems, and he went into art as well. You know, he did the work in the Para-Aragon, where he tries to analyze the picture on the wall as being part of the wall or distinct from the wall, and how it flows, how that is related. So he's not, and he was very interested in architecture too. And he, he knew Peter, and he asked sort of simple questions about architecture, he was very interested in it for really obvious reasons, because of the natural structuralism of it. So I'm just trying to sort of say in this book that this was a period, but it also is still working underneath wherever we are now. It's still at work. I mean, we're still at the question about truth. Is that's a fundamentally sort of philosophical and metaphysical issue, and epistemic issue. You know, we're in serious issues here that threaten certain systems that we believe in, but also we need to open those systems up, like colonialism and how they act. So I don't think we're beyond that, we're different because of what's happened in the interim.
The first question I put to you, and obviously it derives from the title of the book, and it derives from the beginning of the book as well, is this discussion about the role of theory within architecture in general, which is again a loaded kind of idea, and we continue to labor as teachers within architecture schools who have a relationship to practice, to the professional discipline of architecture. We still struggle with this kind of tension, but your book sets out, before it gets going into the various chapters and discussions, it establishes a kind of justification for a theoretical architecture, and the way you put it, architecture made of theory, not theory made of architecture. Perhaps it would be good to kind of understand this a little bit more, because even it's not just the discipline that, the profession that comes back to architecture schools and says, you don't know what you're doing. It's also kind of that moment where you have to persuade an architecture student that there is value in the course, there is value in this kind of other way of thinking.
It's hard for me to imagine, I think, an architecture that has no theory. Now, this runs into a lot of questions, like it runs into, what do you mean by architecture? Do you include everything as potentially architectural, or do you just include certain periods of time or later modernist sort of from the Renaissance forward, back in, is this started all in Greece, or is it in Asia? And how did we come to think, how do we think now about what counts as architecture? So that question is always asked, and it shrinks and it expands and it shrinks and it expands. And so I was thinking that theory, post-structural theory, it was an expansion of theory in some way in relationship to architecture, and architecture was interested and it was involved. So that would, and I, since that was my training, that was the area that was somehow driving a number of things that I talk about. However, there are in untold numbers of theories throughout architectural history. Durand's theory, an incredible theory, it decides that functionalism utility is really the seminal basis of architecture, and that produced an entirely different pedagogical system. Modernism's theories, endless theories of the less is more, and all these ways of sort of establishing order and using particular materials and bringing materials into particular relations. How is this not theoretical? It's completely theoretical. You know, it requires discussions and agreements, and it desires canonical, overturning canonical practices or, you know, other things. And so, of course, it's theoretical. It's not as if canonical overturns are just happening of their own. Nothing is more strong in a canon than staying put, right? Not being overthrown. So the overthrowing requires theorization. It requires imagining another way in which it would be, things would be arranged or ordered. So I can't, you know, it's theoretical. So, and it's the same with, you know, any of many other Vitruvius's, you know, theory of commodity, firmness to light. Well, I mean, those are like, what? You know, it's like, for we know what that means, but the common, you know, how is firmness and commodity, how do those are related to each other? Or where does the delight get to come in, right? Is it the last thing you do? Is it the first thing you do? So I think it's loaded. And I think sorry to use that word again, loaded, but the theory is, you know, there's specific periods of more maybe intensification of noticing the theoretical issues or, you know, and those are usually a kind of crises when they're trying to overturn certain practices, not in a violent way. I mean, Derrida makes a very strong point that it's not, you can't turn the page on philosophy. You are just want to look at it in a different way. And so it wasn't like deconstruct and take the buildings down sort of thing. It was let's look at these buildings in a different way. Let's look at architectural practices in a different way. Let's see if we can find some of the forces that are at work there. And, you know, also, I mean, there's nothing that theory doesn't include. I mean, it includes the labor and the materials and the capture of what kind of material, what to design, who knows, you know, that's the hard question. Once you decide that, you could figure out the materials far more easily, but the material comes into it. Mm-hmm. So all of that has to be in a certain way brought cohere. And then the coherence of that is really what the building is trying to represent.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're not particularly aesthetically radical or anything, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You talked earlier. You mentioned earlier this. To use the word again, modernism being loaded with the stuff. This kind of idea of a totalizing vision, and you set yourself, or the book sets a kind of the Derridean, which I really like. I've always wondered what it would be. Derridean. It sounds like some kind of.
It does have
a Star Trek, doesn't it?
But it's,
The Derridean. The Derridean would be really spiky, kind of. See bits of their skeletons and wouldn't know where their mouths were. You would have absolutely no idea where their face was.
Right.
But, anyway, the. So
turn the page on mouths. Mouths will always be mouths.
but this idea of the Derrida kind of releasing architecture from this desire for order, which obviously has its roots in colonialism and in the empire project of the European continent, but also the American continent. And I was wondering whether, you might want to sort of, I suppose, unpack that a little bit, explain that lineage in relation to how your book has opened out and discussed it. It's a big question. I mean, I'm asking you questions that would do two PhDs at the same time, but, you know, why the hell not? It's not every day you get to speak to a professor from Pratt.
Well, I don't know if that's good or bad, but What's the question exactly?
that's a good that's
Sorry.
No,
You
no,
can
not at
cut
all.
this part out. Yeah, but my
No, no, no.
question.
It's this idea of, you know, if as you said in your book, you sort of modernism sort of is looking, and I quote, for a kind of a conclusive artifact that both produces the order of that time, but also represents it. So, and Derrida's kind of intervention as a philosopher into the discourse of architecture has this effect of decoupling or breaking apart, fragmenting this idea, which has been amazingly kind of significant. Is the idea that we get out of Derrida that post-modernism, capital M modernism, we end up in a world in which the architect and its and their architecture is sort of unseated in a way, and we're left kind of with fragments that we as architects, as designers, our job is to kind of coordinate these bits.
It's true, and obviously we're still thinking in relatively conventional historical terms about periods when this happened and periods when that happened, and you know, Derrida, they die and they fade away and then something else replaces them. But actually they're all acting within each other in all sorts of ways. I mean, the post-structural movement, so to speak, well, you know, was replaced by the digital movement to some degree, and the digital movement is now being placed in the environmental movement, you know, and so forth. So there's a way in which necessarily periods of intense you know, applications of particular philosophies and so forth can't sustain themselves forever. And they're, because they are kind of little kingdoms in a way, or they're little, even if they're very good and productive and generous and trying to help the discipline, you know, and the practice, they still get very cloistered. And so they need to have something else come in and sort of just scramble them up for a while. But these are not, these, you know, I think that the question of theory, regardless of whether we call it a Derridian theory or not, is, you know, is still at work, because we still have architecture, architects, architectural schools, we have, you know, architectural ideas, we have architectural magazines, we have discussions about architecture endlessly, we are juries trying to figure out what is architecture and what isn't. All the time, we are, you know, we have pedagogy that is loaded with there the word again, the pedagogy that is, okay, forget, you're going to take this part out. Okay, so you have a pedagogy that is you know, working toward goals that try to manifest and represent good design, responsible design, environmental design, you know, et cetera. So really the discipline and practice is very rich with discursive relationships and seeking understanding of itself and understanding of itself in relation to the world. So I think that, you know, I do not make this split between the discipline and the practice. I mean, I understand one happens in academic context and the other is happening out in a very other, you know, multiple contexts of politics and urbanism and all sorts of other things. But I think those parts of it are also already at work. And I've used Derrida as always already at work in the discipline. So that the labor, the ground, the site, the views, the constraints, the access to energy sources, choices, environment, laws, politics, all of that is not a separate socioeconomic sort of piece of the theoretical work in architecture. There's not to mention money or something, but really architecture is in the midst of trying to face the questions of how it, what kind of representation it is actually wants to emphasize or be involved with, and also what would be the proprieties of the time. What's it proper to do right now? Is it proper to have the kitchen and the, you know, the living room in the same place so that everything's all mixed up? Or is it now the right thing to do is to have a public, you know, platform, public, you know, like the POP, the Seagram building introduced? Or is it now proper to attend to happiness and change the datum so they're more humanistic, you know, and so forth? So that's all in the labor and in the ground and site. It's acting there too. It's acting there too. It's why when we now are observing the question of labor in architecture, which has been sort of repressed, not just labor, but, you know, lack of diversity and payments and exploitations and extractions and all these things, that we are now beginning to see how that is theorized in architectural work. And that it's allowed to happen in certain ways that architecture doesn't control 100%, but it actually is trying to move its ideas into, so that it is realized materially as a representation of this, where we are now.
So as you were talking, I was thinking about this word interdisciplinarity, interdisciplinary, which you use at the beginning, and you state as being an important thing, and it comes from your background as a critical theorist. I'm kind of really interested in the way that interdisciplinarity, because the way that you talk, the theorizing of architecture necessarily extends the discipline's reach into other disciplines.
Yes.
And breaks open its carapace, breaks open its shell to allow other disciplines to come into it. And this is a major challenge to kind of modernist ideas of the, you know, the heroic architect and the discipline as something that has a red line around it, like a site which is defended by a professional body, and you're either an architect, but if you call yourself an architect, you're not an architect, you're going to go in the slammer, and so on and so forth. So I'm kind of, yeah, that I think is a really fascinating idea. So maybe how do we engage with that interdisciplinarity in an effective way as architects?
Well, I that's a good question. I'm not sure when I saw it in your in the some of the questions you sent me, you had mentioned the question of interdisciplinarity, and I wasn't sure quite what you meant, but now that you've clarified it, I think I can see what you're getting at. I have always, and this is hubris on my part, but I've always assumed that architecture was one of the most interdisciplinary practices that actually was itself discipline. Yeah. that you can find, you know, and so if you compare it to comp lit is very narrow-minded, you know, and it does entertain, you know, different kinds of literature and so forth, but it doesn't go out into the socio-political unless it's a historical socio-political thing or something. So it's actually, architecture cannot function without disciplinary interactions. It can sit there and say, okay, I'm doing architecture. I would refer to Max Goggin and Merrill Elam, you know, who always say in a very interesting way, they're always experimenting in their architectural firm, but they always say that they're looking for architecture. They're searching for architecture in their work. It's not like they know what to do to make it architectural. They're searching for architecturally. And that's, I think, what's happening with everybody. They're searching for and that's vague. It's like, well, what do you mean? You know, how do you know if you get there, you know? And you don't really know, but you're searching for it. In everything about the discipline practice is about this search for architecture to some degree. And so in order to do that, it cannot, you know, that's why the labor is already at work, you know, or the potential labor, the potential materiality And that's why this aggregate group is doing interesting work, because they're looking at that materiality as theorized and as taking certain assumptions about history and so forth and so forth. So so I think that the, you know, I think it's already interdisciplinary. I don't think it's a unique moment where it suddenly becomes Phil's using philosophy. It's always used philosophy. It always is semi-philosophical. It has its own version, you know. I mean, a philosopher wouldn't look at an architect and say, oh, what a good philosopher that architect is. But in architectural terms, there's like tremendously good philosophy. I mean, in the sense of thinking through and theorizing and so forth, it's very strong. It's every, and it's not, you know, it's not unique. Mm. So but that may be just because I'm out, you know, I'm always seen as somebody coming in from literature, you know, even though I've abandoned literature pretty much for years. I don't know what's going on in Copland now at all. And so maybe it's just my disciplinary sort of irritation, you know, about that. I don't know.
Yeah, I was before we started recording, I mentioned this. I used that thorny word postmodern, and you asked me what I meant, which I love being put on the spot. I'm lying, I don't. One of the images that I keep in mind when I think about postmodern architecture is that Oswald Unger's Berlin, A Green Archipelago, where there's this idea of renewal that he draws based around these small moments. And the spaces between it become, in a way, the way in which those moments gain identity and fruitfulness. And I think that for me, so that it's sort of postmodernism as an exercise in generating spaces, or looking at the spaces between the fixed nodal points of information, the stuff that we can know. I don't know if that's a legitimate way of understanding it, but it's certainly one that I find persuasive, partly because possibly because I thought of it. Anyway,
I think that's very interesting. I mean, I think that we haven't talked about spatiality. You know, I haven't mentioned it that much, but of course it's a seminal issue, and the how. I mean, this is the incredible thing about how architects see the world, you know, and how they look at, you know, they go out and they see things that nobody else sees, because they're looking for not just, you know, the thing there, they're looking at the spatiality of the thing, mm-hmm. and its relationship to spaces around it, in it, you know, between rooms, between, you know, auditoriums, between, you know, parks, and I mean, I one time was asking somebody about what was across the street, whether there was, you know, parking, what happened to the parking spot across the street, who was not an architect. And they said, what parking lot? You know, they don't know about, they never looked at the parking lot, but every architect has looked at that parking lot, you know? So, I mean, to some degree. So you could say that's a sculptic, or really the power of the visual intake, you know, is really very intense. Mm. And maybe artists also could be included in that, or others, you know, other disciplines. But architecture, so I think that is incredibly important to talk about, you know, spatiality and the space between.
That interdisciplinarity generates that space between architecture and the phenomenon, to the materials with which they operate, in which they operate. And it's this that your book really kind of, I think, is a really great, I mean, it's beautifully written, so there is still a bit of complet in you, because you don't write like a total architect. I can understand it, and it's nice to read. But this idea of interdisciplinarity creating spaces, creating that, the gap between, and that gap therefore requiring theorization. So not just in terms of, you know, not thinking about the building, but thinking about the urban network, but also starting to think about the languages that we use as architects to communicate our work to people, thinking about the way that, for example, I don't know, contracts, policies, so on and so forth, become a component part of architecture. And it's by sort of reaching out to policymakers that architects suddenly create this gap of knowledge, which can be, or this gap of practice, that's not just about drawing and building.
Yeah, right.
That we can then theorize.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, I think that is very important and very, very exciting. And if I'm making any contribution to that, I'm glad.
Yeah.
I would agree with you. I mean, I think I would agree with what you said about how that works or how it comes into play. I mean, the writing itself, is always an issue. People always are saying about my work, they're always saying, oh yeah, well, why are you talking about King Lear, and stuff, or what's Antigone doing in here? And why am I using plays and other things like that, And so of course there is a little bit, I mean, the interestingly in the book, the chapter on the amphitheater, I don't know if you read that, but everybody considers that a literary essay and doesn't really belong in this book, they think. So I understand, because in fact it is a literary essay, it's a comp lit sort of throwback, but it's talking about the amphitheater. So, and the amphitheater is hard to understand in a funny way, because it appears in all these antique ways and it's still here in the court of law, and so it's just trying to think of like, well, why is this amphitheater persist, in auditoriums and so on. So it's just trying to track that, but it doesn't, it doesn't really talk enough about its how it's deployed. But yeah, anyway, I guess my point is that people do mention like, oh yeah, it's well written and everything, I guess because you're a literature person or something, and and so that will never end probably. And it's true, I don't write like an architect, but that's actually helpful to what I'm trying to inquire into, I suppose, because I'm allowed, because I'm kind of allowed to do that. And also I think I'm allowed because I come from, and maybe just people are, generous about that, saying, yeah, it's really literary, but but yeah, we still read it and we like it and it's, okay.
I wanted to finish. You mentioned earlier technology, and when we spoke on the phone those many moons ago about doing this, I had just been going through an external examination process on the MArt course that I run, and the two examiners, Tom DePore and Bob Brown, had talked about the kind of technological bent of the course that I lead and that I inherited. And I was quite interested because, to me, the ecological, environmental, and sustainable kind of discourse lacks, in some respect, an overarching theory. That it's a very kind of, some might say, quasi-scientific discourse, which justifies a kind of almost anti-intellectual engagement with the built environment.
Okay.
It might be profoundly ethical, but it certainly isn't theoretical in the sense of deconstructivism, even in the sense of, say, I don't know, arts and crafts movement, certainly not. So we've kind of come to this strange moment where technology, sustainability seems to have been foregrounded to the extent that architects, Richard Rogers, Norman Foster, to name two British examples, are able to sort of simply say, without that, if their building is, environmentally excellent by some kind of mathematical metric, it is good enough. And
that's right. I know exactly what you're talking about. I encountered that in Singapore last summer. where they're, you know, these mega buildings they're doing, and they're covering them with, you know, trees and vines and things, and they're talking about greening the city and so forth, and that they're actually suggesting that technology can take over from nature. You know, technology will accomplish, you know, what the good of the environment. The truth is that the environment cannot be theorized. If we don't have any idea what the environment consists of, we underrate it completely 100, and we make up mythologies about it, and we act in it in our way, just as like a species, just like every other animal. And we, you know, and we know what we know, and that's it. There's a ton more that we don't know. What we know is just, you know, it's because of the kind of cognitive system we have. We select just, you know, what our cognitive system can collect. It doesn't collect the entire environment. So the environment is way too complex, and it's way beyond science at this moment. Still, science is struggling. It's doing these scenario planning, you know, future climate stuff, and it's always wrong. It's not wrong, 100% wrong, but it's wrong, too wrong for us to be claiming that we understand what's going on. We don't understand the environment, and especially because actually in relation to the environment, architectural work is very small. You know, it's a very small thing. It just sort of sees itself as just sort of planted here, and you know, then it accommodates environment in a very general way. Okay, electricity and, you know, blah blah blah, and it gets all that from elsewhere. It doesn't know where, mostly, just taps into the grid, you know, or taps into the system. The system of environment is now in crisis. And because of all sorts of things, all sorts of aspects of it. And really, there is no theory of it. You know, people are going back to, you know, these other, you know, to the theory of nature and the history of nature and whether nature exists. And, you know, they're saying, you know, dark ecology and all this other stuff. And it's giving small little instances or ways of thinking about nature that is radically different than the way we generally think about it. So I would just say it's theorization of environment is a theorization of something so large and so complex that we have to deal with it the way complexity theory deals with it. There's not an answer to the question. There's not an end game. There's not a particular character to it that you can pin down and depend upon. There is the fact of just living in environments that certifies that environment exists. And that's usually where we're approaching it from our own kind of life theory, you know, like, okay, it's good for people to have sun and trees and stuff. But I really do not think it is enough for an architect to just sort of figure that the carbon footprint and putting of trees in the lobbies and, you know, having French architect is doing, Nouvelle is doing with, you know, systems of energy systems and so forth. All of that is interesting. And maybe this is like the digital age. We're learning, you know, that technology. But it doesn't stand in for architecture. In fact, what the trees in Singapore are doing is basically a cloaking architecture behind these things. And who knows what it is? Or it's, you don't have to do our architectural thinking per se if you cloak it in that way, because now you've satisfied the environmental demand. So I think it's a huge issue for us now, you know. And I think we're in a kind of cynical period, even in spite of being ethical. I think it's very cynical what architects are doing.
I'm interested in this, like, the relationship of theory to ethics. I mean, I know obviously ethics sits within the broader philosophical discourse, but it seems to me that the way that you describe in the book, you describe the action of theorizing buildings is useful insofar. And I don't want to instrumentalize it, but it is useful insofar as it helps us, and to go back to Foucault, unpack the organizing dynamics,
and
such
space.
As power,
yeah,
in space. And so perhaps what we're needing right now is some form of robust theorizing of an environmental architecture because theory can help us formulate an ethic that is actually meaningful.
Well, I don't know if it would reveal an ethic, but it would certainly can critique the kind of ethics we think we're doing, and then we might find something underneath that or in that we can turn in a different direction or see in a different way that allows us to slowly, gradually sort of pull apart what's this environmental theorist or theory might be. Because it's definitely going to be like complexity theory. It's not going to have a solution, and it's not going to, it's not going to solve our problems, but it's going to be interesting because that it will reflect on how we're approaching it now, potentially. But it sounds a little bit idealistic, to say that we can can actually find it. But I think it's a great question. I think it's a serious question now.
Yeah. So the future looks like less didactic, less hubristic, less definitive and monolithic theorizing, and more speculation and ambiguity, and a kind of, I suppose, a delicate stitching together of realities into a kind of a collaging, I suppose.
Well, but that's what deconstruction was, essentially, in its day. That's what it was doing. It was delicate. It was going in delicately. It wasn't just smashing through and saying, oh, you're wrong, this other thing is right. It wasn't interested in a right answer. It was interested in the inquiry. You lift up the hood, you look in, you see an engine or engines or machinery or governments or whatever you see, and centers, and you see these centricity of these concepts that drive the car that you've opened the hood of and allow it to do what it does. And you begin to ask, have we asked questions about the driver, not the driver of the car, but the driving principles at work here? It turns out to be some, sort of energy or whatever it is. We know about that, the, combustion and so forth. But what we don't know about is how that's located as a incredibly powerful economic issue or an incredibly powerful sort of even a incredibly powerful sort of resemblance to other such machines that drive things. And talking about just technically, it's like incredible how we have all these machines deployed all over the place in different places, and we don't really associate them with each other, and yet they are associated, and that's what the whole grid is about. But I think that the construction was very delicate in trying to just find out, and that the centricity issue was the key. In other words, it was the whole all about, is there a center here that is out of play, that is not, that we're not conscious of, that is at work, but we don't know what it's doing? And is that there? And it's not, we don't know what it's doing because we're not allowed to know what it's doing for some reason. I don't know if that's, just government or something. Kind of being scared of some kind of conspiracy or something. It's just that it's, the center is out of play. And that's what it, that's if it finds that the center is not allowed to be questioned or somehow is so powerful that we can't think of another solution to it, then we're in trouble because we know that actually it can't possibly be the final solution. to the things that, you know, can't, it didn't, it wasn't the solution to sort of pollution from cars, you know, it's not the solution to, you know, so we have a car, it's fabulous, but it, the center of carness is not, doesn't answer all the questions, and it doesn't, you know, so that's, and then new things, and then new questions come up. So I think that you could say, you could waste your time doing that and just say, cars are cars, we're just going to build better cars, less pollution, and that's what we do. But it's laborious and really low, you know, so expensive, and also a huge administrative costs, and is also, you know, requires roads and everything else. So it's a huge deal to change the car. The Tesla is like a huge deal, that it's going to change the whole, you know, character of that.
I quite like this, the parallel to the way that we think about architecture is sort of opening the hood of architecture and trying to start to question, you know, these basic principles, these uninterrogated dynamics that occur in the form of architecture, in the delivery of architecture, in the conception, in the maintenance of architecture, of cities, of urban systems, and so on and so forth, which we certainly need more of.
Yeah.
I didn't want to finish myself, but I think we'll finish there. Thank you so much, Catherine. I've enjoyed speaking to you a huge amount.
Okay, thank you.
Architecture without theory is blind, but theory without architecture is mere intellectual play, as Kant might have said. To which one might respond, well, what's so wrong with play, misery guts? Thanks to Catherine for recording and recording this with me, and to MIT for the book. Links to all relevant info are in the podcast description, and thanks for listening.